Accession number 10180, reel 6.
John Hatfield, Reel 6. You were telling me about these souvenirs and foodstuffs that you used to buy in Gibraltar.
Yes.
You've got a further point on
that. Well, everybody used to do this, and that was part of another great naval institution known as rabbits. Whenever a seaman goes ashore, that included going home from barracks, he would always try and take home some presents. And for some reason, they were called rabbits. And people have tried to explain this as saying in the old days people went ashore and shot animals and had the rabbit, or stole rabbits, and the ears were sticking out so people could tell that they were doing something, taking something that wasn't theirs. I don't know what the origin was, and I'd love to know, but it was a very strong custom that when you went home you took presents with you, food or souvenirs, things of that sort. I suppose in the old days, parrots, the old thing that sailors were supposed to take from abroad. So we did that, and of course drink was very cheap in Gibraltar. There was literally no duty. You could buy a bottle of whiskey for, I've forgotten what the price was now, but just the cost of production, virtually, whiskey and gin. So people used to buy some of that and take it home as well.
How did you get on with the Gibraltarians? I mean, you said Gibraltarians.
Gibraltarians.
Yes.
rock scorpions. Well, for some reason, there again, they were heartily despised by all the British forces, which was very unfair, because they tended to live on the forces. Therefore, obviously, they tended to try and extract money from you. Maybe that's why they were despised. They were called calientes. It's another slang word, which in Spanish means hot. Now, again, I never discovered where that came from, why they should call them hot. We didn't get on badly in the sense that people fought them much, but we didn't like them very much.
So, and from Gibraltar you'd sail?
From Gibraltar we'd sail up and down the straits trying to find German submarines, and then along the Moroccan coast.
You had no contact with German submarines?
No, not at that time, no. And I remember how beautiful the little beaches on the Moroccan coast looked. I used to think, when the war was over, I'd like to go there. It seemed a kind of symbol of peacefulness and beauty. Because although I was saying in many ways I enjoyed being at sea, there was an atmosphere of worry and sordidness, and you knew that England was being bombed, and generally it was very pretty unpleasant, and so everybody's thoughts were mostly on when the war would end. For instance, there used to be the famous song, which has all variations, like about the end of the war, when will peace come, you know, roll on peace, people used to say, roll on peace. And the little song I'm trying to remember ends up something about this one funnel bastard is no fucking good. You know, it's a well-known tune which people used, which was again a way of it to say you didn't like the war. So Gibraltar was a great break, and of course the sun while we were patrolling that area was very nice too, before you went back to the gales in the Atlantic.
And then you sailed back to Liverpool?
Then we sailed back to Liverpool with a convoy. And that was one of the most dangerous runs, of course, because it was right through the middle of the Atlantic battle. But we never saw a submarine, which seemed to me, it made me feel inferior, because you read all about the Battle of the Atlantic in the press, and we never saw it. But of course the battle consists largely of making sure nothing does happen. We may have been shadowed, but
were you aware of that at the time, that sort of argument?
Oh yes, yes. And of course we knew that if a submarine appeared, even if we sank it, people would get killed and the ships would get sunk, merchant ships. But on the whole, at the time, obviously you were very relieved if you came off watch and nothing had happened.
Did you see any aircraft during that last stretch?
No, not that time. In the next convoy we did. But that time we didn't. But there were all sorts of false alarms and rumours.
Such as?
Such as that there are a lot of submarines about, and You know, you want to be able to watch it, mate. You know, you're going to get it this time, this kind of thing. But where they came from, I don't know. No, we didn't. The main thing was that it was just difficult getting from A to B against the gales. Sometimes they were really bad, and the whole of the upper deck would get washed over, and you had to rig lifelines to make sure you weren't washed overboard, and all the water came into the mess deck. If it was cold, I remember one time going on watch wearing slacks and one or two jerseys and a duffel coat, a very thick, heavy naval duffel coat, and an oilskin on top of that, we could just about get on, and sea boots, and climbing to the top of the mast in that to be in the lookout in the crow's nest, and not feeling that I was wearing too much. Then, of course, coming back and finding that everything was completely soaked, and having to find more clothes to go and watch the next time. That's the sort of thing that happened.
Did the weather ever frighten you, the size of the waves and sort of...
No, I think we had confidence in the ship. We thought that although they rolled a lot, corvettes were well built, and as long as you didn't get washed overboard, it was more a nuisance than anything else.
When you got back to Liverpool, you'd be living on board ship, obviously. How long would you spend in harbour?
I think about a fortnight, if you weren't having a refit. If there was something wrong with the engine, of course, you'd have to stay longer. And every so many hours, the engine needed maintenance, and every so long, the ship needed a bigger refit. But we just had one, so we didn't stay very long. We went out again soon after.
Would you get leave?
Yes, we did get leave, sometimes quite short. I can remember, I think it was then, or it might have been later, but I think it was then, travelling down to Brighton, where my parents lived, taking something like 36 hours to get there, 36 hours to get back, and being home for about a day. We used to do things like that. Shore leave in Liverpool, yes, that was very depressing, because Liverpool had been very badly bombed, and all around the dockyard area, there wasn't very much. There was a Catholic mission for seamen, which was a bit depressing, and not much else. So we used to walk into town, and again, I thought then Liverpool was an awful place. Since then I've found I like it, but it seemed incredibly depressing. And again, another lot of people we despised were Liverpudlians and dockyard workers, dockyard mateys. The story was that the dockyard mateys would wait at the gate for the seamen and say, "Have you got a ciggy for the workers?" This is a sort of cliche, because, of course, we had duty-free cigarettes. And so when we went ashore, we didn't do much. We just sort of wandered around and came back again.
Now, the subsequent convoys all followed a pretty similar pattern.
Same pattern, yes.
Could you then just describe any notable incidents
right, that
you remember?
Well, one was nothing to do with the war, really, but when we were right in the middle of the Atlantic, for some reason, which I still don't know, a boat came to us out from, I imagine, from the sloop, which was our senior officer, and in it there was a young engineer officer who presumably had come on board to see to something wrong, and he turned out to be somebody who was at the technical college in Brighton with me. I recognised him at once. I remembered him as somebody who took part in amateur dramatics with me. He was called Nightingale, and he was always known as Flossie, from obviously Florence Nightingale. And I could see the Brighton Technical College scarf floating in the wind in the middle of the Atlantic, which I thought of at the time as an incredible coincidence. But he didn't seem very interested to see me, and he just went on with his work and disappeared. That was the sort of strange thing that happened. Apart from that, I think we were shadowed by aircraft at some stage, but I may have mixed that up with something that happened later in another ship. And the routine, we just followed it. We went to Gibraltar, came back a few times. But on my second or third trip back, by that time it was getting to the stage where we were supposed to be examined for our CW business. And as I've explained, we were tested for rowing. We were given a little bit of a sort of verbal going through on other things. And we realised that shortly we were going to be sent off the ship, and I think perhaps some of the other crew members were too, because they used to change the crew around fairly often in ships in those days.
Were you sorry to leave?
Yeah, I was, actually. I liked the ship, and I very much enjoyed being a member of a community of people who had absolutely no nonsense, who were doing something sensible, what they had to do, and I enjoyed very much the contact with people from other parts of the country, because I hadn't met many people from other parts, and also people from other walks of life, which I found them, they were good for me. It did me a lot of good.
Right, so you came to the end of your period with the Carnation. What happened then? Where were you sent to?
Well, then I went on long leave. This was a strange thing during the war. You had long periods of long leave when they didn't know what to do with you. So I think I was at home for a few weeks. And then I was summoned by one of these marvellous letters from the my Lord's Commissioners of the Admiralty to, in old-fashioned language, to appear on a certain day at a school, requisition school, which I think was called Modon House, a prep school, in Hove, which by pure coincidence happened to be near where I lived anyway. And there we went through a series of boards to be taken on or not as a cadet.
Now that would be in roughly May 1942.
Yes. So I passed the board, and we all were very busy in this
what
little
sort
place.
What things were these boards testing you on?
Well, they were really just a way of checking from the paperwork about you whether you seemed a sensible person. I think basically they were trying to get an impression of your personality, really. But of course we were all terrified. We'd be asked all kinds of complicated questions about naval tactics and how to make a reef knot and things like that, which we didn't at all. I think the board consisted of retired admirals and captains, people of that type. Maybe, I think they were all naval. They might have been a civil servant. And one of the boards, I remember, had a model ship made of brass on the table, which we thought was going to be used, but wasn't. It was just an ornament. So I think basically they wanted to know if we were good chaps and if we had officer-like qualities, or OLQ, which was something that was invented at some stage by somebody and never properly defined.
Were you aware of what you thought officer-like
qualities
were?
Well, I was aware of what I thought they were, and I was aware right through, I should have mentioned this, that we were supposed to have it. And while we were on board the Carnation as seamen, we were supposed to demonstrate officer-like qualities as well in some complicated way. We were supposed to combine the... somehow be a good seaman, do what you were told, but show that you had officer-like qualities.
And what would you say these were?
Well, you were supposed... officer-like qualities meant... well, partly, I'm afraid, speaking with the proper accent, although not officially. In other words, showing that you were educated and so on. Having some kind of evidence that you could be a leader. Being quick at using your own initiative. And what they call power of command, that's it. They didn't use the word leader, power of command. So you had to show that in an emergency you could do your job, that you would fit in properly, not be a kind of maverick. I mean, you weren't a guerrilla leader. You were supposed to fit in with the naval way of doing things. Intelligent, able to understand things, difficult instructions, able to run a ship, too. But you learned that later. And generally inspire confidence, both in people below you and above you. So it was a complicated mixture of things. But we used to laugh at it. You see, even we who wanted to be officers used to laugh at this idea of having OLQ.
So you passed these naval boards, this
yes.
school in Hove.
Yes.
Where did they send you then?
Well, from there, after a few weeks, which incidentally included training, we were there for quite some time, and we were...
What sort of training?
Used to be trained in sort of generally shaking us up and preparing us to be trained as officers rather than as seamen. Tougher. We were supposed to show that we were tough. For instance, gas mask training. We were made to put on gas masks, double around the playground a number of times, the playing field, until we were absolutely puffed. Then go into a room full of tear gas and take our gas masks off and sort of put up with it. Things like that. Anyway, after a while, and we were given some training in, basic training in, very basic in things like navigation and naval discipline and that sort of thing. Then we went to Lancing College, which had also been taken over by the Navy, which I suppose was called HMS something, but I can't remember. And after a few weeks there, on the same kind of thing, but more intensive, lectures on gunnery, seamanship, ship handling, naval records and correspondence, that sort of thing, and a lot of drill, because we were supposed to be even better at drill by that time. We were then allowed to put on white bands on our caps, which meant we were cadets, I think, just before we left there, on the sort of passing out parade. And then we went to HMS King Alfred, which was the main base in Hove. See, I was very lucky right through all that period. I was doing it all near my home base. HMS King Alfred was some very nice new swimming baths and ballroom complex and so on that had been built by the corporation just before the war, but never used. And that was taken over by the Navy as a training base.
Now, can we look in more detail at the training that you were getting there? What exactly did it consist of?
Well, when we got to King Alfred, it then got to a much higher level. We were by then embryonic officers, or we were cadets, you see. We'd been stamped. We were sort of as though you had had confirmation in the church. The Holy Spirit had descended on you, and you were now cadets. That meant you were different from seamen. And so we were expected to be much more lively and alert and responsible than we would have been before. The training was largely to give you that sense of responsibility and initiative, liveliness. So we had lectures, again, more intensive lectures on navigation. Serious, how to navigate a ship.
Practical?
No, not really on navigation. Because that would have involved taking us all onto ships and outside. There wasn't time, you see.
But
we
use the instruments that you would have to use.
Oh, yes, we had compasses and sightseeing things that you have on the compass to take the sights, like prisms that you line up. And we had practical training in gunnery. We had sort of mock guns and that kind of thing. We also had duties. We took it in turns to be in charge of the patrol, the platoon that was always on duty in case the invasion came or in case it was an air raid. We also did sentry duty. I remember guarding Hove.
Back to the patrol. Yes. What would that involve when you were in charge of patrol?
How did you go about that? You would turn up at a certain time in full gear with gaiters and boots and... you would draw a rifle and be ready to repel the German army. And then one of us, I think later actually, one of us would then be the officer in charge and would have to actually act as an officer in charge of a group of men. That was towards the end of the training.
But what would you do with the men?
Well, you'd inspect them, make sure they were okay, and then send them back to wait for the invasion. So they just sat around as guard, if you like. But we used to keep sentry duty as individuals, guarding Hove Front. I remember that little bit of front marching up and down at night. Again, it was a way of training you to be on duty and alert, because I don't think they really thought that you could repel the invasion. But people were doing this kind of thing all along. I mean, my father in the Home Guard was probably doing the same thing further down a few miles away in Brighton, Brighton Pier. Amusement arcade he used to guard. At the base of the pier. So that was the sort of a very intensive short course in everything an officer had to know, including an awful lot of training in having better officer-like qualities, which was mostly practical, like taking command of a group in drill and drilling them, you know, slope arms, and present arms, form fours, all this kind of thing, which meant that you had to be quite good at making people do what you wanted, because it's not easy actually to give drill to a group of men. And you'd have petty officers, mostly the instructors were petty officers, marching around telling you what to do.
What about training in how to behave in the mess and things like that?
I don't remember being trained to. No, you were supposed to know that. And of course, while we were cadets, we still ate very much as we had done on the lower deck. We didn't have any special mess ceremonial or special food. We just had a canteen and we just sat down and ate it.
But was there anything in Royal Naval traditions like passing the port?
Well, all that came later, yes.
But you didn't cover
that? At that stage, no. No, at that stage it was all very down to earth. Now, there were a few people who had been through King Alfred and had failed at the last minute as officers, and they were kept on. It was rather pathetic. They were kept on as still with their cadet bands as instructors. We all felt very sorry for them because they'd failed for an it might have been their eyesight, it might have been that they just didn't have enough OLQ, but they had enough to teach us, you see. That's the strange thing. So after a period of so many weeks, we then finally, if we passed, were given a commission. And all that meant was that you were paraded, and as far as I remember, the names were read out, and you then were allowed to go and buy yourself an officer's uniform.
Now, what exact rank were you given?
Acting sub-lieutenant. Temporary acting sub-lieutenant, RNVR.
And that would be in August 1942, would it?
Yeah, that's right. So I went along to... tailors came, it's quite funny, tailors would come at the right crucial moment to the place and sort of set out their wares. And I went and got a uniform, which I didn't like. It didn't fit me very well. But once we had that, we then continued our training for a further few weeks, wearing an officer's reefer jacket, an officer's cap, grey flannel trousers, gaiters, because whenever you're ashore, you wear gaiters because of to prevent them flapping around. And instead of a collar and tie, you wore a very sensible, a white scarf. Quite smart and very sensible, because it was better for marching around and doing things. My mother got me a scarf, and there again, it annoyed me, things, stupid things. She got me a very good quality, very fine woolen, off-white scarf, and everybody else had a silk or artificial silk, pure white scarf, and mine tickled. So there you are, I see, mothers don't know what to do sometimes.
How did you get on with your fellow cadets?
There was a great esprit de corps. We all were very keen, very cheerful. We all sort of got on quite well. Some I liked more than others. And there was one that I made friends with at Lancing College, who, in a way, I thought he was a bit pompous, but in another way, I liked him very much. And I got in touch with him many, many years later, quite recently, by pure chance. I saw him in the street, and since then I've kept in touch. And he's now a clergyman. We got on very well on the whole. We had our own groups of friends and just were very keen to get through and finish and get on with it.
When you finished, what happened then?
Well, then again, another period of long leave. And I should say, all this time, I felt a bit of a fraud living so close to where I was, able to get home on whenever we had a few hours leave ashore, I could go and visit my parents. It made me feel I was being too cosseted. And also, perhaps, it was not enough of a separation. It maybe meant I kept too much of contact with home. But still, I liked being there, so I did it. We had long leave again, and then got our first appointment. Now, when we were given our passing out boards, one of the routines was to ask us what sort of ship we wanted to serve in. And I had asked to serve in motor torpedo boats.
Why? What had put you onto them?
Well, several of us had been talking about this, and it sounded exciting. It sounded, they're very fast. It's the equivalent in the Navy, in a way, of, I don't know, a sort of small groups of commandos or a fighter pilot. It meant that you were independent, fast, used your initiative, didn't have big ship routine, etc. So all the things we'd been trained to do, to me, seemed logically right in a type of ship of that sort. And it fitted in with my personality, I think, better to be in that kind of small boat than in some place where there was a lot of routine and you only did things in a certain way, etc. So although I was frightened, I mean, I thought, what am I doing? Is it the right thing to do? Because it sounded very dangerous. And then I decided, well, that's what the point isn't to avoid danger, you're supposed to do what you can. And so I put in for it, and a bit to my surprise, I was accepted.
Did a lot of people apply for the MTB?
Yeah, well, this friend did, and a few, not the majority didn't. The majority wanted to be in things like destroyers or corvettes.
You didn't think of the corvette thing, having been in a corvette?
I'd thought of it, yes, but I thought it was more exciting to go in motor torpedo boats.
So where were, after this long
leave... So after this long leave, I received a letter again from my Lord's Commissioners of the Admiralty appointing me to MTB 621 of the 31st MTB Flotilla, which I had to report to the captain in St. Helens, near Glasgow. So I went up there by train, went to St. Helens, found the place, the boat, after some difficulty, because it's very small.
What month was this, do you know?
This was about September.
42.
Found the place and reported. And the boat had just been built. It was the first one of a new set of D-class MTBs.
Could you describe this boat
yes.
now, and the armament, and
yes,
how many
I can't,
people were aboard?
Right. I can't remember the length, and because I was always very vague about arithmetic, so I didn't really know the length of it properly. But it was a quite relatively big for a torpedo boat, and it had three officers, which was again a lot for a torpedo boat. The crew, I think, was about 18 or something of that sort, maybe a bit more. It had two torpedo tubes mounted on the deck, a quick firing gun on the forecastle, which I think must have been an Oerlikon, and I think it had twin 0.5 machine guns in a revolving turret aft, and it had a few depth charges and smaller machine guns mounted in different places against aircraft.
So there were three officers.
Three
and
officers,
18 men.
About 18 or 20 men. I may have underestimated the number of men.
Would every, there's a lot of armament
yes.
to be used by
yes.
very few men. Was everybody familiar with how to use everything?
In theory, everybody was supposed to be able to use everything in a torpedo boat, so that if somebody was killed, you'd suddenly switch all, do a sort of musical chairs and switch around. But there were people whose job was, action station was, to man particular things. Yeah, I think maybe it was more than 20, but round about 20, slightly over.
So you picked up this boat at St. Helens.
Yeah.
What was your initial impression of the captain and of the boat?
Well, I liked the boat. It seemed... I'd never seen one before, of course. It seemed impressive and interesting. They were made of plywood, incidentally, 12-ply wood, and with big aircraft engines, Packard engines, petrol burning. The captain was a two-ringer RN, a lieutenant RN.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, Gooden. And of course, a two-ringer RN was that sort of somebody much higher and more impressive than we'd normally associated with. He was rather an intense sort of man, outwardly very pleasant, and we got on all right at first. But he was a bit cold. I suppose this RN atmosphere made officers more cold. He always used to call me sub, which was the way you call a junior officer in the Navy, which annoyed me. He treated me a bit as if I was a midshipman. I suppose to him I must have seemed unbelievably wet. The